I'll call the meeting to order. Representative Lencheski is stuck in traffic, as many of us were coming in this morning, so I do appreciate those that are here. Members, we have several handouts. And we have presenters today that this is the only day that they can do this. So we do have to proceed, despite the fact that we're a little light on members here. In terms of handouts, you have a handout from fiscal on the 2007 fastest growing expenditure report. We have a handout from research, which was a follow-up to member questions in committee. There's a state taxation and military pensions. And also in your folder are the assessment reports that we will be going through. There's one on Ag Land, Green Acres, Rural Woodlands, and Resort Property. Okay. Gordon Folkman, John Hagen from the Department of Revenue, would you like to proceed?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Gordon Folkman. I'm the Director of the Property Tax Division with the Department of Revenue. And as the Chair indicated, we're here to provide you with a brief overview of the three reports that we were mandated to do and was delivered to the legislature last year. Just to maybe give you some context for the reports, I think it was in the 2005 legislative session. There was a number of reports that the legislature mandated the departments to undertake, and the three reports that were due last year and presented to the legislature were the reports on the rural woodlands assessment practices, resort property, and the ag land green acres report. The general thrust of the mandate was for us to really look at some issues pertaining to uniformity and accuracy of assessment, and where appropriate, make recommendations along those lines. The legislature in the 2005 session also mandated the department to look at additional reports that were due this year, and those reports are on Class 4D property, programs enrolled in state and federal conservation land, residential classification, uniformity, and commercial industrial property. Those reports will be presented to the legislature between now and the end of February. As they come available and become completed, we'd like to schedule those at over the next couple of weeks as they become available. Having said that, then, what I'd like to just give you is a brief overview of some of the process involved in doing these reports. One of the things that we did, we tried to form working groups with the assessors, so the department utilized a number of assessors and their expertise, their knowledge of the regional market throughout the state. And so to address these reports, we formed working groups comprised then of DOR staff as well as county assessors. And when appropriate, we also then touched base with various stakeholders when that was required as well. I'd also like to let the committee know that building upon the experiences that we had over the last year dealing with the these issues, last fall, the Property Tax Division also established an Assessment Practices Oversight Committee, which is primarily comprised of a number of assessors. And the purpose of this committee is to look at these issues in a more ongoing basis. Specifically, the purpose of this committee is to help the Department of Revenue and the Property Tax Division specifically to more systematically review the classification assessment issues on a more rigorous ongoing basis. And so we're trying to follow up with the mandated reports and the approach that we took with those reports in a more systematic, ongoing way. Don, are we still scheduled to deal with the Green Acres first, or how do you want to?
Yeah, we can, I guess.
Or do we want to? We were prepared to do Green Acres first, Ag Value, and then the rural woodlands and resorts, but because we have some assessors and some of our staff not here.
We should do it all with them. It's not people there.
So we would find, if you wouldn't mind, Madam Chair, we would do the woodlands first. What I would like to then do, turn it over to, are you going to say anything? Steph?
Yeah, Stephanie.
Turn it over to Stephanie Nias. She's a staff person in the Property Tax Division. And Mel Hentz, he's the county assessor of St. Louis County. And both of those are very much involved in putting together the woodlands report. And I'll have them provide an overview.
Could you please identify yourself?
I'm Stephanie Nyhus. I'm a principal appraiser with the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
And I'm Mel Hentz. I'm the St. Louis County Assessor.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our report that we did last year. What we're going to do is go over the executive summary for you, first of all. The initial charge of this committee was to analyze the existing classification practices for vacant, rural, wooded, non-agricultural property. After analyzing the existing practices, several issues were raised. Most importantly, there's a wide variety of legitimate potential uses and thus classifications of property for vacant, rural, wooded land across the state of Minnesota. The potential of these uses varies within a single county and between counties, and therefore it contributes to the perceived lack of uniformity with taxpayers. Mel is going to talk a little bit about this today and how the different uses and different classifications impact land in St. Louis County.
Madam Chair, what I'd like to do is just give you a little background on St. Louis County, talk about a typical rural parcel in our county, and then cover the five different classifications that we use in our counties for that same typical parcel. And so as far as our county, we have 107,000 taxable parcels. We have a very large county, I think, as most of you know. It's a very diverse county, ranging from Duluth on the south boundary all the way up to the Canadian border. In between, we have the Iron Range, which has a long history of mining. There are currently six taconite mining operations in our county. North of the Iron Range, we have our Prime Lake area and lakes like Burnside and Vermilion, Eagles Nest Chain, Pelican, I think are probably familiar names to a lot of the folks down in the metro area because that's where you like to come up on vacation. We have destinations like the Bounty Waters Canoe Area, the Voyageurs National Park, and so we have a lot of diverse property types in our county. We've seen, like, in our county, much like the rest of the Arrowhead region, a very rapid escalation in prices of rural land. The days of buying a 40 for anywhere from $10,000 to $12,000 are long gone. And now, at the very minimum, it's going to cost you $30,000 to $40,000 for a 40-acre tract. And if you get in the Ely area, it's probably going to cost you somewhere around $100,000 to $120,000 for a 40-acre parcel. I'd like to just to vision a typical parcel in our county. And that would typically be a 40-acre parcel. It'd be located on a gravel road. You'd have a mixture of vegetation, perhaps some aspen and birch and some conifer vegetation. It'd have gravel and rocky soils. It might be level, or it could be a rolling topography, or it could be quite steep if you get up in the Burnside Lake area. And there's no improvements or any signs of active use. And of the 107,000 taxable parcels in our county, we have roughly 22% of our parcels are rural parcels greater than 10 acres in size. Now, keep in mind that typical parcel, and also keep in mind the diversity in our county. Here are some of the classifications we would use on a typical parcel. If the parcel is located, say, 5 miles north of Duluth, where we're seeing a lot of development, a lot of pressure for rural home sites, we would have that parcel classified as non-homestead residential. If, on the other hand, that parcel is located in northern St. Louis County, north of the Iron Range, it did not abut any public water, and it was maybe commingled with public land and some paper company land, we would have that parcel classified as timber. Another example would be if that parcel was located, let's say, a quarter mile from Lake Vermilion, where we're seeing a lot of pressure for second-tier development. In that instance, we would have it classified as seasonal recreational residential. And, again, that same parcel, that same typical parcel, if it's located within a quarter mile of mining activity, we would have it classified as industrial. And then yet the fifth scenario here is if that parcel was located anywhere in our county and it was part of let's say, an 80-acre homestead, and the base parcel had the home on it and the second parcel is undeveloped, we would have it classified as residential homestead along with the base parcel. What this results in is all of these classifications result in a different tax impact. And it creates a perception that there's some unfairness going on in terms of the responsibility for paying the county and the school district and the local government share the levy. These differences are not understood by the taxpayer. Our records, like many counties, are out on the internet now, and so people are scrutinizing those classifications to much greater detail than they have in the past. We've had appeals at the local board level and at the county board level appealing for a classification that maybe a few years ago they didn't want because of tax implications. Now they want that classification because they know that it's a lower tax, and so you have the shifting sands going back and forth. And so that's the environment we deal with. And then you have these boundaries between, let's say, that parcel one that was just out of the city of Duluth where we use residential non-homestead. Where do you stop using that class and begin using the timber class? And the same thing when you get around to Prime Lake. Where do you stop using that seasonal recreational class and begin using timber? So you have all these boundaries that are out there because of the different classifications. And so I think the recommendation that Stephanie is going to present provide a good solution to that problem.
Thank you.
We do want to emphasize that this is for rural, wooded, non-agricultural property. Any property that is wooded that would be contiguous to farmland under the same ownership would be continued to be classified as wood or as farm. Our main recommendation would be to introduce a new classification for rural vacant land. As Mel was talking about, that right now rural vacant land can be classified as any one of a number of classifications of property. It needs to be classified according to its most probable, highest, and best use. As Mel was saying, this in his county specifically leads to about five or six possible classifications of property, each with their own tax rate and each with different implications with the state general tax. The rural vacant land classification in our recommendation would be limited to property that is at least 10 acres in size and that is not used agriculturally. We believe this would contribute to the uniformity of classification practices when the number of possible classifications is narrowed to one, and that being rural vacant land. We also came up with a recommendation on the split classification of property. Typically, assessors are quite hesitant to split classify properties that consist of one identifiable use where there is an excess large amount of wooded property. Mainly, this is due to the existence of limited market value. What our recommendation was here, again, this can be largely resolved by establishing a new rural vacant land classification. And in the absence of a law change that would implement that, the department would issue specific guidelines on split classification of properties. In this case, we would probably recommend only split classing properties that are 40-plus acres in size. The third recommendation concerned the classification of land that is used primarily for hunting. Many rural parcels of property are leased for hunting purposes. The lease may be for a period of as little as one day to as many as 3 weeks, and assessors typically are not made aware of such hunting leases. Since this use is relatively minimal and incidental to the primary use of the property, which would be vacant land, many assessors believe we should implement the rural vacant land class and classify property that is primarily used for hunting as rural vacant land. Right now, assessors are split between classifying that property as seasonal recreational property versus timber versus wooded non-agricultural or wooded property that is part of a farm. Short rotation woody crops, assessors, again, as a result of our survey that we did last year, were quite divided on the proper classification of property that is used to grow short rotation woody crops, such as hybrid poplars. Some assessors believed it should be considered to be trees grown for sale as a crop, as referenced in the agricultural statute, and others believed, since they are grown for typically for paper or pulp purposes, that it should be classified as a timber property. The recommendation, again, with the short rural vacant land class, we feel that this non-uniformity would be corrected. In the absence of a change for rural vacant land, we would recommend that these properties be classed agricultural because the procedures for growing short rotation woody crops are kind of a hybrid between agricultural production and timber management. Those were basically the four recommendations that we would come up with for this committee.
Representative Markman.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I do appreciate the department's efforts on this. I think anything we can do to make this simpler and more transparent is always a benefit. And I had one question as you are looking at this rural vacant land classification. And you mentioned the hunting land, and what happens in the agricultural area is that land is sold, and it's primarily for hunting, but it's in an ag classification and dries up all the ag land because of the sales ratios. Now, if we were to go with a new classification, would those type of sales then affect rural, this new rural vacant classification and not the ag land, so it would be totally separate when assessors looked at the sales ratio?
Madam Chair, Representatives, I believe that would be the case if we separated them into the rural vacant land. They would have their own separate classification of property and would not be compared to sales of primarily tillable or other ag use properties.
Thank you.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And, the question I guess I have is we try to make things simpler and more transparent and more understandable, whether we're really accomplishing that. And I think we all have the same goal in doing that. But does just changing the classification or adding a classification really accomplish that is, I guess, the ultimate goal? I mean, it seems as though the misunderstanding or lack of understanding is still going to be there. So how do you balance those things, and how do you actually come to a more understandable system by adding things in? It seems that makes it more complex.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do believe in the long run that this would make it more uniform and less complex. Right now, as Mel was saying earlier, there are several different possible classifications for rural vacant land, such as wooded property, because it needs to be classified according to its most probable, highest, and best use. And there are so many options for that right now. We believe limiting those options to one, which is the rural vacant land, would increase uniformity and hopefully, ultimately, increase understandability of the tax system for the taxpayer.
Representative Brown.
Well, Madam Chair, thank you very, very much. Maybe I misunderstood then. So the intent is to take away all those other classifications, not to leave them in play, and essentially they will be not eligible for assessors to use. Is that correct then?
Madam Chair, Representative, typically that would be correct. These would still be in effect for improved properties. A property on a lake with a cabin could still be classified as seasonal, recreational, residential. This would mainly be for rural vacant land where there is no improvements or minor improvements and there is not an easily identifiable use to that land. It would probably eliminate the need for the timber classification.
Representative Brown.
One more question, Madam Chair. Do you have the number of classifications that we have? I just don't recall the total number. Do you know that?
Representative, Madam Chair, I believe there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 35.
Thank you.
Is that it?
Thank you.
Next week.
Madam Chair, members.
That was quick.
Yeah. The next report that we would like to be able to review with you is the one on the Ag Value Green Acres. And this is a one that we weren't able to present last year before committee. We were a little bit late in getting it completed. We did get it to the legislature late, but we did not have a chance to review the report with you. So this is sort of an opportunity now to give that first cut. I just wanted to say a few couple opening remarks about the report before I turn it over to John and Stephen Hacken, who's the county assessor from Winona. This was a fairly challenging exercise for us, not only for the department, but I think it's an ongoing issue and significant challenge for the assessors as well. One of the things that we discovered early on in trying to compile the information and proceed with the report, there was a significant lack of good data and reliable data on agricultural values throughout the state. And we also have problems with data in terms of uniformity and how assessors use the different classifications, such as tillable or non-tillable, waste, highland, lowland, those kinds of things. And the last thing that came into play that created some complications in reviewing this this program was the more current existence of non-agricultural influences are changing significantly throughout the state. One of the things that were probably driving this whole program was first conceptualized back in 1967 was looking at the metropolitan area and how the economic development growth was spreading out from within the metro area. The non-agricultural influences were pretty much perceived to be those kinds of factors. But in recent times, we've had a number of other types of influences, such as recreational, hunting use, those kinds of things. We've also seen some investment decisions out there that might be skewing the market in one way or another. So the whole concept of non-agricultural influences has become a very much of a challenge for us to try and get our hands around. So in some respects, all these things came to a head and created a significant a hurdle for us to try and begin to jump over from last year. I just want to let the committee know that this was our first step to try and get some understanding of the issues that are around the green acres and ag value problem. And one of the things we're doing this year is to try to follow up on this report. And we have a working group in progress right now. And the mission of that working group is to try and take, at the beginning anyway, this report and try and develop some comprehensive guidelines in a Green Acres Ag Value Bulletin. And one of the first things that that group is going to be looking at is the whole issue of coming up with a good ag value as it would apply to the current law definitions predicated on some kind of sales methodology, but something that we can use more uniformly throughout the state. So I just want to let you know that we're trying to follow up on the report, and there's a lot of work to be done. And we'll talk a little bit about that follow-up as part of this presentation as well. Having said that, I'll turn it over to John and Steve.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Hagan. I'm the Assistant Director with the Property Tax Division. And I apologize at the outset so your expectations are properly set, since we're missing one-third of our group and we really haven't had an opportunity to coordinate this, but hopefully it'll be somewhat informational. I'd like to start off initially by reviewing the actual Green Acres law for you, just to remind you a little bit of what's involved. The Green Acres property tax program was developed in 1967, and it was initially intended only to apply to the seven-county metro area. The law is somewhat unusual in that it includes a mission statement or a policy statement for the law, which I'll read to you. It says that, and it always has said for the Green Acres Law, the present general system of ad valorem property taxation in the state of Minnesota does not provide an equitable basis for taxation of certain agricultural properties and has resulted in inadequate taxes on some lands and excessive taxes on others. Therefore, it is hereby declared that to be the public policy of this state that the public interest would best be served by equalizing tax burdens upon agricultural property within the state through the appropriate taxing measures. And again, that applied initially to the seven-county metro area. We're not getting into all the exceptions. All the exceptions involving the many complex potentials of Green Acres qualification. Green Acres basically applies to real estate consisting of 10 acres or more that's classified by the assessor as agricultural. There's an income requirement that to qualify 33 or 30% of the farm income must come from the property, from the land, or, which almost never is the case, but or more prevalently, provides the owner of the property has a production value of $300 plus $10 per tillable acre to qualify for Green Acres. Now, it's interesting to note that when the Green Acres law was first implemented in 1967, the income requirements were significantly higher. Initially, the income requirements were $750 for the farmer, plus a value of $25 per tillable acre. And that was rolled back in 1969 to that $300 and $10 per acre, which stayed ever since. Additionally, to qualify, the property in question has to either be the homestead of the owner or a qualified relative, or it has to be owned, has to be an uninterrupted ownership of 7 or more years, or it can be real estate that's farmed in conjunction with one of those. So if you have non-contiguous farmland that's farmed by the homesteaded farm owner, that would qualify, as would if it was owned by the 7 years. Now, the Green Acres Law is unique in that it requires the assessor to establish two different values for the agricultural properties. The highest and best use value, which is the value that assessors typically establish for all properties in the state, reflecting basically what the property would sell for if it were exposed for sale in an actual market situation. A second value, and where the problems really come in, is establishing a value of the property as agricultural, the agricultural worth of the property. I should note that special assessments are also deferred under the Green Acres program. The property owner continues to benefit from the Green Acres tax exclusion until they sell the property, or they no longer, or they lose their homestead or cease homesteading the property, or there's a few other potentials too. When that occurs, the property owner has to go back and pay the difference of the difference between the high tax and the low tax for a period of 3 years. So if you own it for 3 years and no longer qualify, there'd be no benefit. If you own it for longer than that, you would benefit by paying tax only on the low value of the property. Since its inception in 1967, the use of Green Acres has spread to 43 counties, and it's that was when we did the report. I'm guessing it's that number is even greater today. Initially, when Green Acres was envisioned, I think it was envisioned only to apply the problems of urban sprawl and lands that were proximate to lakeshore land, where clearly the land value is higher. Since that time, there's been a lot of other market effects that have started to come into play, which is why the Green Acres program has expanded so much. You've got a lot of seasonal recreational demand for these types of property, and then a great deal of investment demand for these kinds of property, where people find their investments are better served in real estate than in the stock market. Shortly after we started to get into this into the committee work on this Green Acres program, we realized we had a really difficult kind of Mr. Fulton alluded to. One of the biggest problems we came up with right away is we tried to survey counties for existing practices to try to make some meaningful comparisons, and we found that there's really no current reliable data that exists that's readily identifiable and can be applied to various counties. There's a great deal of variation in how counties value farmland. Some counties value the farmland based on crop equivalency ratings, and we thought that might be the silver bullet. The crop equivalency ratings basically measures the potential of the growth potential of the soil, the degree days, and the tendency to be erosion, towards erosion, things like that. So we thought that'd be an outstanding way of valuing farmland. As it turned out, it really is not meaningful in that crop equivalency ratings vary from one county to the next. You could have exactly the same soil type from one county to the next, and you can have different crop equivalency ratings. You cannot compare crop equivalency ratings between two counties. And in fact, the University of Minnesota, that was a big, if they didn't develop the crop equivalency rating concept, they at least continued to upgrade it. And they quit supporting the whole program, and basically they recommended that we not go down that road. So it sort of left us at a crossroads trying to figure out what would be a good way to value agricultural lands, or to compare agricultural lands. To add to the confusion, some counties value ag lands still at ABC. Some counties have gone to a basis where they value agricultural lands based on uplands or lowlands and nothing else. You have upland property, lowland property. Other counties have found that markets are dictating that oftentimes the property is being sold by tillable land or non-tillable land, and those are the only two breakdowns they have. So early on, we discovered we were going to have a real difficult time trying to make any meaningful comparison. Additionally, we some of the old truths that we took for granted going into the committee meetings, that the best land sold for the highest prices and that farmers would buy lands based upon the earnings potential of the land is no longer so true anymore. Our understanding now is that a lot of times farmers would buy land because a lot of those old truths that you'd pay much more for really good farmland and less for lesser farmland because of changed farming techniques, because of the advances in fertilizer and advances in hybrid seeds that allow farmers to do a lot more with a lot less land. A lot of that has changed now, so it becomes more, the farmers are in a position where they're actually competing more. The market is being established more through farmers competing with other potential buyers than with based on the actual productivity of the land. And another interesting fact that came to light in the committee was that a lot of times a farmer will buy land and based on what they call a generational opportunity to buy the land. Where in a lot of parts of the state, the land may only come available once in a lifetime of the farmer or that family farm. Consequently, they're forced to buy the land if they want it, even though they feel it's worth, they're paying way more than it would be worth as farmland. And they'll continue to farm it, but they feel, again, it's a generational opportunity to buy this farmland, acquire the farmland, and add it to their farm. Steve, do you want to talk a little bit? Like I said, we haven't had a great opportunity to rehearse this. We had about 2 minutes this morning. Steve Hacken, Winona County Assessment, would you like to comment on some of the difficulties in valuing farmland?
Well, I think one of the main concerns we have, even in Winona, is that you know, we have, frankly, you know, out-of-towners, whatever, coming in and, you know, who really don't care about the farmland value. Rather, you know, they're either, you know, trying to get some stock money invested or, you know, they're buying hunting land or whatever. I've been county assessor in Winona County for 10 years. When I came down there in 1997, the assessors were valuing woodlands at $150 an acre, and today our sale prices are getting anywhere from $2,500 to $3,000 an acre for that kind of property. In Winona, because of the topography, et cetera, you know, probably half of our rural land is very hilly and very wooded, and you know, the farmer's ability to create income off of that land is limited at best. Yet much of it sits in the middle of farms. We have sales coming where they have surveys that go right around the wooded land, and we have a lot of those kind of things going on. The other thing we have is our zoning laws have set a one house per 40 acre rule, which means that we have a lot of properties being sold just to build houses on out in the rural areas, and those prices certainly aren't, you know, consistent with farmland prices.
Right.
So, I mean, that's some of the things that have made Green Acres move away from the metro, I think. And I worked in Chisago County for a number of years, so that's almost metro today. So I kind of think I understand the inside and the outside a little bit, you know, both on those. I think one of the other issues that, you know, that just happens is that I don't think there's any state in the country right now that taxes farmland based on its market value. I did a research here probably 3 years ago for an article I wrote that was published in the National Assessors Organization publication, and every state that we researched had some kind of program where they got off of market value and into some other form to tax farmland at. So, you know, I think that the idea of having something different like this for farmland makes us not unique, but rather typical for other states.
Mr. Hack, I'm just north of you with Wabasha and Goodhue County.
Okay.
I, in fact, live in a township where we're, last count, we have 6 farmers left in the township. So, you know, it's a very changed landscape.
Thanks, Steve. Another problem we encountered was that in our mind, the identification of non-agriculturals, as Mr. Hacken mentioned, is much harder now than it was 10 or 20 years ago. And at that time, you looked typically at proximity to a lake, urban sprawl, things like that. But now we have the hunting influence, the seasonal rec influence, and I would argue, or submit to you, I guess, that since 9/11, it seems like that was sort of a line in the sand point in time when a lot of investors took their money out of the stock market for obvious reasons and started to invest in the real estate market. And I think it really, because of the increased demand, it really drove the real estate market. So we had a situation where there was all this demand to buy seasonal lands or farmlands or any types of lands just because of the security it offered. And the problem that the obvious response to that problem would be you just look at land. If a non-farmer buys it, then that would be a non-farm sale. The problem that we encounter, though, is farmers are competing in that same market. So if they don't buy it, even though they're competing with the other properties, they don't get it. And then we had to try to identify at what point is a farmer actually functioning as an investor as well. And a lot of times farmers will buy property thinking it's maybe more than they can make it cash flow for at the time or more than they can pay for it, but they also have the potential for an investment down the road too. So it just got so muddy that we have a lot more questions than we have answers at this point in time, which is why Mr. Fortman said we're continuing to look for solutions to a lot of these issues.
Just another thing that's really changed in the market is this auction thing that's going out there, where just about all of our rural land right now seems to be sold at auction, you know, very heavily advertised, and frankly developers are in there, and you know, it's very much of a mix out here, and that's one of the reasons that the price of this stuff I think has really gone up a lot, especially in the last few years on that.
And to tag on what Mr. Hacken's saying, we've had this phenomenon of the 1031 exchanges too, which has been another issue we've tried to deal with, where the farmers the investors have to get rid of their money on a 1031 exchange. And our initial sense was that we should throw these sales out as being non-representative of the market. But as often happens in a marketplace, a 1031 exchange would set the upper limit of value for a short period of time. But when a farmer down the road realizes that another farmer sold his property for X number of dollars, so in a very short period of time, that seems to set the upper level of that market, and it becomes the market. So there's all these economic factors at play that are making it so incredibly difficult for us to try to identify what actually is an agricultural value of a property. Assessors are remarkably good, as all of you probably know from your own personal property taxes. They're remarkably good at developing a good estimate of highest and best use value as are required by law. They're remarkably good at estimating what a property will sell for. The difficulty is that when we're trying to determine an agricultural value, when it becomes less and less possible to do that. I heard an economist from the University of Minnesota say probably 10 years ago that in his opinion, he didn't believe there were any agricultural sales, purely agricultural sales, that were driven simply on the potential of that land to produce income, even at that point in time, which is 10 years ago, and it certainly has gotten much worse since that point in time. Some of the recommendations contained in the report, and I would urge you to read it at your leisure, preferably just before bedtime, I would think, some of the recommendations is we would like the legislature to clarify what the actual intent of the Green Acres language is. The stated intent of the law seems to be to equalize tax burdens. We have sort of made the assumption over time it's sort of more that legislative intent is sort of morphed into a way to protect farmers from the escalating taxes and not driving farmers off the land. But the stated actual intent of the Green Acres was to equalize the tax burden between properties. The committee recommends that the legislature review the law and the stated purpose and clarify the intent as it deems appropriate. The committee further recommended that the department should continue to analyze agricultural sales, try to identify agricultural sales throughout the state and try to achieve as much uniformity as possible. And the committee also recommended that the department take a more active role in facilitating inter-county and regional meetings that would address agricultural values and cross-county value comparisons. The committee also examined the issue of when and when should Green Acres be implemented and when should it not. We also have, believe it or not, we have counties that are reluctant to go into Green Acres because of the administrative work or the perceived administrative work, so some counties are very, very reluctant to enter into Green Acres. I think that old mindset is starting to die out, but we've had situations where one county, which maybe even shared a city, would be in Green Acres, and a county immediately adjacent to it with exactly the same market influences would not be in Green Acres, which when you have that sort of an equity, that created some problems. I believe most of that problem is gone, but now we have another problem that's starting to take its place, is where some counties are going widespread into Green Acres throughout all their property, and even lands in some cases may not be subject to external market characteristics. They're inserting the actual agricultural land, saying that's the highest and best use land, highest and best use value, excuse me, and reducing that value to another arbitrary lower value and saying that's the agricultural value. So we've got all spectrum of issues with that, and we have to take a more active role, and in fact we are taking a more active role in trying to deal with those.
Excuse me, we have a question here. Representative Manning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question on the Green Acres, since you just got to that. Can you explain to me why Brits Bar in downtown Minneapolis is Green Acres and how much of the value of that property is treated? I mean, it's across from Orchestra Hall.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulvey, to be perfectly accurate, Brits Bar is open space, not Green Acres. It's the same civil program, and I would like to have that explained to me as well, quite honestly. There's a provision in law that allows for, I think it's outdoor recreational, and they have a bocce ball field, I understand, on top of their parking ramp, and they, in utilizing with the bar, and they were successful in getting a special tax break to recognize the recreational benefits of bocce ball. And I would urge you to take a look at that as a legislative body. I'd be very happy.
Representative Mulvey.
Sure, just as a follow-up, how much of it then is treated, is the whole parking ramp, or what is treated, or how, what advantages do they get in that kind of situation?
I'm sure, Representative Mulvey, it's a significant advantage. It works exactly like the Green Acres program, so I can see why you would confuse the two a little, but they pay at a much lesser value on the portion of their, that is their bocce ball course. Now, my understanding is Brits Bar has been very aggressive in pursuing every advantage they can get, where they've even maintained a certain amount of their participants are there just for the purpose of bocce ball, mm-hmm. and consequently they've had part of the parking ramp be assigned as open space as well. So I do commend you for wanting to look at that. I certainly encourage that. That would be a nice thing to have off the books.
All right, thank you.
Without question, and this is where we're really going to miss the third part of this act, without question, and Mr. Hackner referred to it a little bit too, the most difficult part of the Green Acres is this classification issues, and there are a lot of issues that come up, but by far the most difficult aspect of the whole concept of Green Acres is coming up with an agricultural value. The current law requires the assessor to determine agricultural values by using sales outside of the metro area, and as I mentioned, it's so difficult to find agricultural sales that are not impacted by some other non-agricultural factor anywhere in the state. Our current working group is trying to look at some other alternatives which might look at, as an example, we're exploring sales of lands in the western regions of the state, which are arguably less subject to other external characteristics, less subject to seasonal recreational effects or urban sprawl and things like that. And we're actually looking at the potential of maybe taking those values, adjusting them for a number of variables and trying to apply those values horizontally across the state with similar degree dates is one proposal. Another proposal we're looking at is we've conceptually identified five counties in southwestern Minnesota, Rock, Noble, some of those counties, and said these counties are probably the truest agricultural area in the state that has the least outside economic activity taking place. I don't mean economic activity, outside economic characteristics that are affecting the market. And we've made some amazingly good progress in going back to a sales period from 1991 to 96, which regrettably is as far back in time as we can go on our agricultural values. Before that, it's all gone. And we've made just conceptually, we were looking at saying in 1991, 1990, in that period of time, ag land sales were as pure throughout the state as they can be. Consequently, all the sales values in the state at that time reflected actual pure agricultural activity. To that, we have looked at the five counties in southwestern Minnesota and seen what has happened to their market values and how much they've increased or changed over time. And we have applied that percentage to that set percentage in throughout the rest of the state, as an example, if in Roosevelt County, lands from that period of time reflected sales of maybe $200 an acre, and the lands in the southwestern portion of the state had increased by 60%, we would increase the $200 by 60%, and which would be, it's certainly not perfect, it's a lot of smoke and mirrors, but there is actually some rationalization to it when you actually go into the in-depth basis for it. And we're having remarkable success at that, quite honestly. It's not really that we can really prove it, but in the absence of the market constraints we have and the comparisons we have, it may in the end be the best potential we have for actually trying to make some sort of a meaningful agricultural predictor throughout the state. So that's such a brief synopsis of what's going on there that I don't expect any of you to follow it at all, because I don't even follow it as I say it. But it is interesting. We are trying to do things throughout the state and trying to identify some way of coming up with some value that is somewhat reflective of actual agricultural values. And in all probability, if we're successful, it'll be green acres will be very widely implemented, and I would guess through most, 70 to 80 of the counties in Minnesota.
Excuse me, Representative Brown.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, the uses of the property, do you have any data on the uses of the property pre-sale versus after sale? I wonder if you could draw some conclusions based on whether the property is used for ag by the owner or whether it's used as a rental, land rents for adjacent property owners. Can you draw some conclusions from those?
Madam Chairman, Representative Broad, we can to a certain extent. We can if the land supposedly changes hands, and you can make some extrapolations if a property owner from Chicago acquires property in Kitson County, there's a good probability they won't be farming the land. As far as they're renting it, we really don't always know that. We don't have a good accurate measure of that. And it's been one of the frustrating parts in trying to determine what is and is not ag land, because what very often happens, the ag land is, of course, predicated on the use of the land, is agricultural land. Very often the people that are acquiring this land, this farmland, they're buying it for hunting lands, and it's in their best interest for hunting land purposes to continue to have it farmed. So there's getting to be a great deal of rental farm transactions that end up being part of the agricultural study and continue to be used agriculturally, but we really can't identify what is rented and what is not with any great ease anyway.
Thank you. To that point, Madam Chair, what in identifying in some of these out of state owners, hunting owners, how is the CRP or CREP, or have you factored any of that? Because for CRP, some of the registration processes, I would think with the federal government, remember there was a website 5 years ago that had everybody who owned anything and got a government contract or a government subsidy, get everything listed on there. I'm wondering if it has to have some sort of agricultural tie to be in the CRP program, if you can identify it that way.
Madam Chair, Representative Zellers, we probably could. One unfortunate aspect we actually thought of looking at for legislative support on trying to identify CREP in CRP and RIM lands is there is not a requirement that they notify the assessor of the existence of that. So oftentimes the assessor is not even aware of the existence of that. I'm aware there is a report out there. I don't know how widely that's utilized, but that may be another issue we come to you asking for help with.
All right.
One other issue that we a final issue, I guess, of a major issues contained in the report is we would like the legislature to look again at the income requirements of the Green Acres legislation. As I mentioned, they were higher in 1967. They were $750 income and $25 per acre. In 69, they were reduced to $300 income with a $10 per acre, and they've remained unchanged since that time. The downside for this body is that there would be some potentially people put off Green Acres that were more of the marginal farmers. The committee sort of felt that the benefits of the Green Acres program was so extensive we would like it to apply really as much as we can identify to the pure farmers, the people that are earning their living or participating in farming as a career, and not so much the hunters and stuff that are just keeping a few acres open for the deer population. So that is one of the recommendations contained in the report. But again, there would be some potential regional impacts and some people might be put out. I believe with that concludes my synopsis of the report. Do you have any questions?
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, Mr. Folkman?
Our last summary will be on the resorts report that we provided last year, and it looks like we end up having Gary Obelson or from our staff also is here, so we should have almost a full complement for this one.
Steve Pujol.
And Steve Pujol from Castle.
Welcome. If you could identify yourself for the tape, and I want to thank Representative Wolschlager for filling me out here this morning. It took me a while. I do care about what happened in the previous testimony. It took me 40 minutes to get through Bloomington, so for anybody coming from the south, it's about a two-hour drive to come in, so I apologize. I missed the first two presentations. Heard them in Fairmont, Minnesota, though, I think. So looking forward to this report, and thank you, Representative Wolschlager. Proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for having us here. My name is Gary Amundson. I'm a regional representative with the Department of Revenue. This is Steve Pujol, Cass County Assessor. He participated in this working group with us. I also enjoyed the commute this morning. I left home at 6 o'clock and just arrived here 15 minutes ago. Several times during my commute down, I was dreaming about laying on a beach on a resort as I watched cars in the ditch and emergency vehicles scrambling around me, but that's, I guess, neither here nor there. We're here to talk about resorts this morning. And resorts have been kind of an integral part of our culture in Minnesota for decades, and I'm sure many of you have many childhood memories of spending time at a Minnesota resort. Resorts as we know them are changing right now. The industry is changing. It's being caused by an increase in property values, increased competition for resort patrons' time in other recreational pursuits, increased operating costs, and a number of other things have impacted the resort industry in the last few years. We took that into consideration when we formed this committee. Our purpose in this undertaking was to study the assessment of resort property and to formulate some policies and hopefully recommend some legislative changes that would allow us to improve the uniformity in resort assessments in Minnesota. To accomplish this, we formed a working group. Myself and Mr. Kuha sat on that group along with several other assessors and members of the Department of Revenue. There's a list on page one of your report of the members of that committee, if you would could refer to that now or in the future. I won't go over that with you. One of the things that became immediately obvious to us as we looked at the assessment of resorts in Minnesota, that besides the changing resort industry, which really makes valuing classifying resorts much more complex, we discovered there was considerable ambiguity in the resort assessment statute as far as definitions go and things like that. And the first thing we did in formulating our committee and starting our work was we formulated a survey to assessors. And we asked them a number of questions about how they classify and value resort property for property tax purposes. And that survey is duplicated for you in the report, as are the results of the survey, and they're tabulated in that. And many of the recommendations that I'm going to talk to you about this morning come as a result of the responses to that survey. A lot of things we're trying to do is to just codify what is happening in many cases right now throughout Minnesota. Because of that ambiguity in the statute, the assessors were in some instances kind of finding their own ways. And we looked at what most assessors were doing, and in many instances, if you look at the survey at your leisure at a later time, you'll see that a lot of things we're going to recommend are based on the responses to that and just kind of trying to maintain the status quo to some degree if we can. We believe that the best way that we can promote assessment uniformity in the state is to adopt some key clarifications to our existing statutes that I'll talk about today, and also for the department to adopt some concise policies in areas that don't require statutory change, and to issue a bulletin to assessors outlining policies and procedures as far as resort valuation and classification. I think we'll focus mainly this morning on the areas that we're asking for the legislature to address. And we can briefly touch on areas that we can address through a policy initiative. But I'm not sure we're going to spend a lot of your time on that this morning. one of the first issues that we looked at was resort valuation. And in 2005, members of this of these bodies heard a lot of testimony and people saying that the valuation of resorts was not uniform across the state. And one of the things they told you is that some counties valued resorts based on their development potential or as developed properties, and others did not. And we wanted to get to the bottom of that question and find out what the answer really was. We found it really difficult to compare resort values because they have such unique properties. No two are alike. And there's a relatively small amount of sales data that's available on resorts. So rather than being able to compare sales ratios or compare one resort in one county to another resort in another county, we found the best thing we could probably do would be to address some procedures. And we asked them what their procedures were in valuing resort property. And we found out that virtually all counties value the land on resort property based on sales of other land on that lake or similar lakes within the county, even though it wasn't resort property. And that was fairly universal among assessors in following that practice. And in reality, it probably was their only choice due to the scarcity of resort sales. What we did find was that some assessors would look at the property and consider that it possibly could be developed and therefore maybe had more value as development property than it did as a resort. And other assessors looked at it and said, well, we're not going to consider the development potential, but we're going to consider the intense use of a resort. And they increased the value of the land based on an intensive use. So the end result was that the values, at least as far as procedures went, seemed to be fairly uniform. I think the difference that you heard about in 2005 was more perceptual than it was actual, and that it was the way assessors described the way they value resorts rather than the way they actually did it. One of the concepts in appraisal that we rely on is a concept called highest and best use, and there's a definition of that within your package as well, and I won't go through that. But current law states that we value property at market value, and implicit within that definition of market value is the concept of highest and best use. And it says property should be valued at its highest and best use, and in a nutshell, it's the use that would produce the highest return to the property. And in light of that, our final conclusion was that we as assessors need to value resorts at their highest and best use. And that may be as a resort, and that may be as some other use, as some potential development may provide a more beneficial use to the property. And to do that, we need to ask assessors to do some analysis and look at the configuration of a resort, the market trends that are occurring in a particular county, and determine what that highest and best use is, and then value the property at that highest and best use. And we didn't feel there were as many differences or lack of uniformity within valuation procedures as there were classification procedures after we got through with our survey. So with that, I think we're going to go right to some classification procedures. One of the first things that we considered in looking at resort assessments was the definition that's in statute of resort properties. And as we looked at that, we came up with a number of recommendations we had to clarify that statute and make it easier for assessors to administer their classifications. Some of the things that we would like to clarify is we think there should be a minimum number of units required to be a resort. We think we need a clearer definition of what a unit is. There are many different types of rental units available out there on resorts now. We need clarification in the law that a resort must provide recreational activities to differentiate it from a hotel or motel. We also would request some clarification on the classification of camping pads, and clear direction on the classification of resort property when the right to use specific units is transferred to an individual. And as we go through this, I'll take a minute to talk about each of those. Right now, the resort definition doesn't specify that it needs to be any specific number of units. We looked at some statutory language that the Department of Health uses in describing resorts and determining licensing requirements, and that statute says that if a resort has five or more rooms, cottages, or enclosures, they're required to be licensed. Subsequent to our group's meeting, the DNR had some working groups working that defined a resort as having three units. We think it's important that there be a number of units. We put five in the report. We're not really married to that number. We don't really cling to that. In fact, we had some discussions with some members of the Resort Congress, and they would prefer three units, and we could certainly live with that. But we think it's important that there be a minimum number of units because there are a lot of different types of vacation rentals out there. And having a minimum number of units to exclude some of those really minor type uses from receiving the pretty significant benefit that resorts get in property taxation. Secondly, we feel that resorts should provide recreational activities. The current statute for 1C resorts did not require that they provide any recreational activities. And what we did was simply borrowed the language from the 4C definition, which requires that they have activities such as renting fish houses, renting boats and motors, snowmobiles, downhill cross-country ski equipment, marina services, launch services, guide services, selling bait and fishing tackle, things like that in order to qualify as a resort. And that list probably certainly isn't all-inclusive. I'm not sure we could write a list that's completely all-inclusive. Thirdly, and this is probably a minor thing, but the definition for a Class 1C resort requires them to abut a lake shoreline. And there are a number of resorts that we are aware of that actually are on rivers. And assessors, I think, have done the correct thing in allowing them to be classified as resorts, even though they don't abut a lake shoreline. But we would simply recommend that be changed to something like abut a meandered body of water. Or front a body of water or something like that, so that those properties also could be included. The definition for a 1C resort also requires that any resort that has value in the third tier, and there are three tiers in the resort classification. There's the first 500,000 is at 0.55%, and the second tier is at, I think, 0.1%, and the third tier, which is 2.2 million and above, is at 1.25%. The law currently says that if they have value in that third tier, they have to meet all the requirements of Class 4C. And we don't think that's correct to classify a property based on its value. We would rather classify the property based on its use. And we could foresee a situation with that language where a property would teeter back and forth in value. One year maybe above 2.2 million, one maybe below 2.2 million. And the requirements then would change from year to year for them to qualify as a 1C resort. So we would just like to see that portion of the language stricken from the law and just base the classification on the use in a case like that. Next, defining a rental unit. And this, I guess, isn't complicated. We would like to see a rental unit defined as a cabin, a condominium, a townhouse, a sleeping room, or a camping pad with water and electrical hookups. Right now, there is no definition within the statute, and all of those types of units exist out there on resorts, and it would just help us to clarify what we're talking about when we say they have to have a minimum number of units, and they have to be rented for a minimum number of days, and all those other things that are contained within the statute. The final thing that we would probably...
Excuse me. Mm-hmm. We have a question, Representative Carlson.
I didn't know if we were taking questions.
Sure.
As we go on. I'm sure when you're talking about definition of a unit, I'm familiar with some resorts where individuals own the condo or the building, and then the resort manages it for them when they're not using it. So would that become the definition of the resort when they're simply managing and training a unit or units?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative, that was the next point I was coming to. So, you're ahead of me. The next point that we would make, and actually the last point regarding legislation, is that we feel that if a rental unit is sold to an individual or the right to use that rental unit is transferred to an individual through other means, and they have some ownership rights in that property, then that unit should no longer qualify as a resort. It would still meet that definition if it was owned by the resort and rented by the resort. We would call that, you know, if it's a cabin or a lodge room or whatever it is, it's... For resort purposes, we'd still refer to that and use that in our definition for a rental unit. But when those units are transferred to private ownership, we don't think they should qualify for the resort class. And indeed, assessors overwhelmingly, I think the percentage was like 67% in the survey, said that they did not feel those units qualified for the resort class, and indeed they were not classifying them as a resort. And our position on that would be, if those units are individually owned but still remain part of a rental pool, we would consider them to be one unit then. And that's part of the reason we want to see a minimum number of units, so that they would not qualify for the resort class, and we would prefer to see them classified as just seasonal residential, seasonal recreational residential at the cabin rate rather than at the resort rate.
Excuse me. Representative Pilstrom, then Simpson. Representative Pilstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So where would timeshares, for example, fall into it? Because if you're actually selling portions to maybe 52 different people, how would that work?
Madam Chair, timeshares currently, in my experience, are not classified as resorts. They are owned as partial interest by a number of people, and those that I am aware of in the state are classified for the majority right now as seasonal residential recreational cabins, as individually owned cabins. Steve maybe can address that. You probably have some in Cass County.
Yes, Madam Chair, members. My name is Steve Kuha. I'm the Cass County Assessor. We do have some timeshare on Gull Lake and other parts. Those are classified typically as seasonal recreational, not as part of a resort.
Representative Simpson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, as I sit here and listen to this, I know we as the legislature requested this, and I think that everybody, I hope everybody's paying attention to this, because we went from about 3,000 resorts down to about 900. And I'm very concerned when we talk about best use and highest value. We will pretty well take care of the rest of the 900 at that rate if we're not real careful. I know one of your recommendations is to, of course, to lower the tax rate, which would be appropriate to do. But I also know it took us 4 years to make that happen. So my question is, are we working with the resort associations on this, or is this revenue, and is this the Assessors Association that's doing this upon our request?
Madam Chairman, Representative, we have spoken with some of the interests that represent the resort industry about this, and to my knowledge, we are pretty much in agreement at this point with them. You bring up an interesting question about the number of resorts that exist and how that's changed over the years. We tried very hard to find out what that true number was, and I'm very interested to know where you got your numbers, because I could not find any reliable source of data as far as the number of resorts. We looked at the number of parcels in the state that were classified as resorts, and in fact the number of parcels is increasing. And I don't know exactly for sure why that is. I think it may be due to the fact that as some of those resorts are developed and they break them into individual units, they continue to be classified as resorts, and the number of parcels is increasing. But, you know, we hear these anecdotal reports constantly that resorts are disappearing, and I think they are to some degree. But I don't know to what degree they are. And that was one thing we would have really liked to have been able to put our hands on some good, solid information about that. And as far as the valuation, we certainly don't want to put resorts out of business. None of us have an interest in that. But this body provided some tax affordability to resorts in 2005 by changing that class rate from 1.0 to 0.55, and we applaud that. We think that's the way to approach tax policy, is through classification rates rather than through valuation. Anytime, in our view, that you start to try to adjust valuations, it becomes much more subjective. And we have the task then of getting 87 different counties to apply a very subjective process in the same way. Whereas when you change the class rate, it's relatively simple. I mean, they all change and they're all treated the same at that point.
Representative Simpson.
Well, to that point, I think Mr. Kuha probably has a pretty decent handle on what's happened in his county in the last 10 years. He probably can give you pretty accurate numbers on how many resorts were there and how many are there today. And I think that information can be received through the Tourism Department pretty well. So I think those numbers are fairly accurate, or else we have two agencies talking two different stories. So I think that information is available. But what you're proposing to do here, there's a lot of things in here I agree with. But when it comes down to trying to, at what point do you take this rate? Do we take the 5.5 down to 0.25 then? Or when do these resorts become to a point where they're not going to take in enough cash to make them profitable? And that's the whole basis of where we're at here. So I think we have to be real careful where we take this. So. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Simpson. I think we have Representative Dill and Lanning, and I do probably want to have Mr. Folkman, or I'm not sure who the right person will be, from Revenue come and to the table and discuss the highest and best use concept. I think it's instructive for members to think about the issue that was just raised, and just I personally agree that classification is the better way as opposed to valuation, but I think members need to understand what the debate is. This is an international concept that assessors use around the world, and so I think it's important for people to understand the basic tenets of valuation versus classification. So I don't know if Mr. Fulton's the right person. I think a couple minutes is instructive for people to think about, but Representative Dill, as you all figure that out.
Thank you, Chair Lincheski. Well, I agree with Representative Simpson. In your first recommendation, it kind of scares the daylights out of me, this idea of using the highest and best use on resorts. And I can tell you that the information that I received, which coincides with the Representative Simpson, is from the Resort Congress, Congress of Minnesota Resorts, and the number of resorts that did exist. And I think Mr. Carlson's in the audience could give us that information. let me just tell you about my own town. Mr. Hintz is does the assessing up there. I see he's in the audience. I live in Crane Lake, and used to be a real vibrant place. Numerous restaurants, numerous bars, or Representative Verkamina could get a libation, did so, adult beverage, and a lot of services. But today, the only resort that exists today in that community is a resort that rents houseboats, because they don't have to pay real estate taxes on the houseboats. And they bring in $5,000 a week, and they go up the lake where there's no real estate taxes. That's the only business model on my side of the lake that it can exist, because all of the other ones got developed. And if we tax all of the resorts on the highest and best use, I mean, ultimately, maybe that's what will be the end result, is that they'll be condoized and planned unit development and all of that. But there's only one person in my community and another one in Ash River that figured out that the only way to beat the system is to rent houseboats, because they aren't cabins, they aren't on the shore, they don't use land, they use a little postage stamp of land, and so they can actually make it work. And, I mean, our resort business up in the East is really in a crisis. And to imagine that we would tax them for something that they don't do, someone who commits to operating a resort, a family particularly, that's been in it for generations, and tax them based on something that someone else might do in a future generation, doesn't seem to make it for me, if I understand what you said in your recommendation.
If I can make a comment regarding a couple of issues that were just raised. The highest, well, getting back to what Representative Simpson referred to, I'm from Walker. Walker is one of those resort communities dependent on tourism. In the 24, 25 years that I've been county assessor in Cass, never have I seen vacant storefronts on Main Street of Walker. We do today. We hand, that's, I think, a direct result of our loss of resorts over the past 10 to 15 years. Our numbers are way down. It isn't necessarily because of taxation, however. It's the drive in the market, and the land values are worth much more than they were in the past. And as any prudent investor or owner of property, you'll take advantage of opportunities to make a profit or to sell property, and rather than changing sheets every Saturday and trying to keep a smile on your face and through Labor Day, because it's pretty tough for resort owners to maintain that, they can sell the property and take the profit and run. So I don't think we can legislate anything that would reduce the opportunity for people to make a profit or to sell. We see a lot of resorts going by the wayside, and that's unfortunate. It's hurting our Main Street economy throughout the state, not only just in Cass County or Walker. But I'm not sure, you know, what we can do about that. And when we talk about some of the recommendations in this report, and in particular the first one, the highest and best use, we on the committee debated that issue quite extensively. And I just want to say that sometimes the highest and best use of these properties is as a resort. With the zoning laws and regulations throughout the counties getting more and more restrictive, some of these properties, there isn't a potential for a subdivision that's going to be really profitable. So sometimes the highest and best use is as a resort, and in that case, you know, we follow that as well. But I just want to say that there's a lot of good items in these reports, not only this report, but the others that you're listening to. And I certainly would encourage you to seriously consider adopting some of them, at least.
Excuse me, Mr. Hagan, I see, is joined at the table. And members, I do want to complete the study before we adjourn. Mr. Folkman's here, Mr. Hagan, Mr. May is the Hennepin County Assessor. I don't know who would like to address this, but I do think, because we're on this issue and it applies to every property, not just seasonal rec. I mean, commercial industrial properties, homeowner properties, utility properties, we value them at highest and best use. And so I think it's helpful for the members here to understand what the theory is behind that. And I think often members feel that if you could just change that, it would fix everything. And actually, it wouldn't. And I think it's important for members to understand why. So if we could just get some fundamental discussion of the concept of highest and best use.
Madam Chairman, John Hagan again with the Property Tax Commission. Highest and best use is basically there's a lot of definitions, which none of which I have in front of me, I might add, which basically speak to the issue of highest and best use being the highest return in dollars that a property owner can receive for selling a property for use that's legal with permissible within zoning requirements. Basically, most properties it sells for its highest and best use. In almost all instances, it's the greatest return to the buyer based on the zoning potential of the property and all the other legal potentials that exist within a sale. We're very, very nervous when discussion moves away from the highest and best use concept, because it really literally is opening a Pandora's box where the whole basis of assessment within Minnesota is based upon highest and best use. On the Green Acres testimony, I talked about how assessors are very good at developing highest and best use as a measure, and there's ample opportunities to measure that value against the market. When you have a lesser value, it gets really problematic, and in the case of Green Acres, we currently find it almost impossible to come up with a lesser value, the agricultural value, which at one point in time there was actually a highest and best use value on agricultural. That potential is because of outside economic influence, has more or less disappeared. Have I missed anything on the highest and best use? I should also add, too, back to the discussion of resorts. We have had a lot of discussion with the resort communities. And I, very honestly, I hope I'm not misrepresenting them, but I really don't think I've ever heard them say that the resorts are closing down because of taxes. Taxes are an issue for them, and they like to keep the taxes low like everybody else they can. And I think they're very grateful to the legislature for the tax breaks that have been given to the resorts. But what the greatest threat to resorts is not the taxes, but the fact that their values are escalating so rapidly, and the development potential, as Mr. Kuhn had mentioned, it's they can take the money now and not have to worry about going through all the difficult job it is earning a living as a resort owner. And a lot of them are, instead of trying to sell it, when they get ready to retire, they just don't want to do it anymore. They'll sell it in the highest and best use. The best economic return to the owner is typically to condominiumize it or to split it up or make it a common interest community, and that optimizes their investment and the return of their dollar.
Mr. Pultman.
Madam Chair, members, I'll just make a very general comment. I'm not an assessor. I always tell the MAAO folks I'm happy that I'm not an assessor. But when I became director of the Property Tax Division about 3 years ago, And we've been confronted with the number of reports and issues that the legislature has raised. One of the things that I sort of picked on fairly quickly is that, and John mentioned this earlier in the presentation, it's been my general observation, not only does law require us to, or require the assessors to come up with this thing called highest and best use, but it's also what the assessors do best in terms of being able to gauge the market, use the market indicators to come up with an estimate value of the property that we are subjecting to it, subjecting tax to it. The problem becomes one of trying to determine to what extent can we get some sense of accuracy of a value that's something other than highest and best use. And why are we being asked to possibly do that with respect to some of the economic factors underlying that particular type of property, the tax preferential that legislators and the policy people want to have, are factors which maybe stimulate this discussion to have some kind of preferred treatment. When we get into trying to define different types of uses and value on those uses, the real problem then becomes, one, how accurate can you reflect that specific use with some kind of market indicator? And second, to what extent does the complication of coming up with this other use become a result that creates significant lack of uniformity throughout the state? And we've discovered that when you look at the Green Acres program, the challenge that's confronted the assessor to come up with ag value, we talked a little bit about that today, within the resort, because of the economic pressures on resort types of business, the idea of not to use highest and best use, but to use some kind of special use called resort use, how do we define that? We have it in the 4D low-income housing area as well. To what extent do you want to come up with a special valuation approach for those properties opposed to highest and best use there? And I think the list can go on in terms of identifying a number of special uses. And I think from the assessor's administrative point of view, the preference would be, if you're trying to achieve the best and most fair and uniform valuation process, use the market, the highest and best use, and use other kinds of levers to deal with the tax preferential, whether it's class rates or what have you. So that's my general take on it, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I certainly understand all the arguments for the use of the principle of highest and best use. The problem that I continue to have with this, though, is the word best, which carries with it some implications of social value judgments that are also going to be made. Let me give you an example. And I've seen this happen. Let's say you've got 6-8 cabins that are stacked kind of together on a couple hundred feet of lakeshore. Obviously, if you only make the judgment on highest and best use and economic considerations, the best use would be to condominiumize it, as you talked about, where that's where you could get the most money for that piece of property. But in the process, you eliminate the possibility of rental, where people can enjoy the lake through rental. You also eliminate, I think, the possibility of maybe those cabins are real old and maybe that is not environmentally friendly to that lake, but you've got that many cabins that concentrated. And so maybe the best use is to really take out all those cabins and have only one or two properties instead, which, given the definition we're dealing with here, would not be allowable. It's not the economic best judgment, but maybe it's the best social judgment in this case. Can you respond to that?
Madam Chair, Representative Lanning, I guess I agree with everything you're saying.
Yeah.
You make a great deal of sense, as you usually do. Always do.
That's why I had John respond.
Unfortunately, the way the economics and the market-driven economics of our society works, there are, I'm sure, instances where a lake would be much better served to have old cabins raised, probably inadequate sewer disposal systems destroyed, and new cabins put in, which is a lesser utilization of the land and the lake, and it allows it for much less intensive use. Unfortunately, it just doesn't seem to happen, and I agree that you make a very good point, and I don't know how it would change to happen. A lot of times, resorts are especially prized by potential developers in that you can a resort typically is a very intensive use of the lakeshore, much more intensive than you can ordinarily experience if you were lotting off lakeshore and putting cabins on it. It's much more dense development. So by the thing that makes resorts so attractive is most zoning zoning provisions allow resorts to kind of minimize and become common interest communities, whereas they can basically retain ownership of the land and sell the individual units, which is made the resorts by virtue of the fact that under current zoning they have that intensive use grandfathered in many cases. So that intensive utilization of the land is so much more, you have so much more potential to optimize your investment or your income off it. And that does create a problem. I have no idea what the solution would be outside of really sort of draconian zoning ordinances that would not allow a common interest community.
Madam Chair, I think the debate will continue.
Yes, and Representative Mueller, if you can wait till the next meeting, I think we're going to adjourn right here. Members, we'll pick this up. I want to just throw out for members to think about that last discussion in the context of eminent domain. So now you can't even do it. It was just proposed. It's with that, members, for adjournment.